condition, my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We got Craig Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 7. NASDAQ Futures down 54. It's after our first up day in a while yesterday, but it seems like we're deciding which way to go today. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
I'm, let's see. Since I got back to Colorado after midnight and got to bed a little bit later than that, I'm tired.
Well, you know, you're still 25, 30. You can do that kind of stuff.
That's right. Yeah, can pull 22-hour days with no ill effects. Well, we'll find out here. If you hear a thump, it'll be my head hitting the keyboard.
Are you wearing sunglasses like the blue sheet?
No. No, it's still dark, though, but it's a lot further than, 108 miles to Chicago?
Yeah. Actually, I'm not so sure it's that far from Joliet to Chicago, but he was a little off. Just saying. Were you one of those guys when you were in the Air Force Academy? Did you, like, wear your sunglasses into the bar like they did an officer and a gentleman?
No. I recall specifically having my sunglasses on someplace... indoors, and an upperclassman told me, you know, take that blankety blank off. You know, you're not the California Highway Patrol.
Ah, you're not, what was that, Broderick Crawford? Something patrol? Highway Patrol, yeah.
It was Highway Patrol with Crawford. I was thinking more along the lines of Chips.
Ah. You know, I'm kind of surprised that one of my, I'll say, acquaintances, his son, I've mentioned to you, he's in the Air Force Academy. He's actually had a couple of really good... he spent a summer in Scotland, which is pretty cool. And then I think he's in Japan or somewhere. But I didn't realize... from what this guy tells me, it's a big deal for somebody to opt to be a pilot. I just assume sort of everybody. Why would I assume that? But you have to be... If you decided junior year or something, you actually want to be a pilot, you have to have the right grade. You have to... It's not just a normal thing. Is it newer? Is it always like that?
So assignment night is a deal, and you know, when people get their initial assignments, so that's always been a big deal.
Where did you
pilot,
go?
Pilot training. I don't know about assignments by graduation order of merit, but that actually makes sense. When I was there, the only graduation order of merit assignments that were out there were the post academy education opportunities. So if you wanted to go to med school or one of the other, you know, get another advanced degree, you had to have pretty good grades. Generally, for a pilot training slot, and you got to remember, in the 1977, pilot training slots weren't limited the way they are now.
Why do I find that really odd? I always assume you're taking pilot lessons when you're a freshman or something. Well, I guess I'm wrong, obviously.
Well, the slots, you know, flying slots are limited now, and so if you want to be a pilot, if you want to go to flight training, it's a competitive process. Back in the day, if you could graduate, you would get a slot. They don't have enough slots now. So because we have fewer aircraft, when they graduate or when they're competing for assignments, they rack and comment. The line was rack and stack. They rack and stack the applicants. And I'm not sure exactly what the determinative factors are. It would be a combination of your graduation order of merit is a combination of your grades and your conduct score. You know, it's called your military rating, your military order of merit rating, and that thing would, you'd get a rating on that, and then your academics, and they were merged in some kind of composite number, and that would place your class rank. So class rank drives these selections, I assume. I don't know if they are making, you know, a pilot training slot is designated now. As you go in, you enter as a designated fighter pilot or a designated multi-engine pilot, and I'm not sure if the order of merit drives those selections. If, you know, because the guys, everybody coming out of the place wants a fighter. You know, you all want to fly fighters. So rather than having the top end of your class all be fighter pilots, they want to leaven the performers across the ratings of the aircraft.
I don't think this dude could even apply to it until he was like a junior or something.
Right. Yeah, that sounds right. Now, you're also right that they start giving people exposure to flying right away. So everybody I think, or used to be, everybody becomes, for example, a glider pilot. You get your first experience with learning to fly in a glider.
So this guy's done none of that. So
yeah, well, that's yeah, and I mean, I will say this: the academy has one of the best glider schools in the country, and it's one of the best places to fly gliders because it's right up against the mountains, and you get a wave that you can ride a glider for hours. I mean, I stayed aloft for like over 2.5 hours one day, and just as a beginner. So they start everybody with the idea that, okay, we're going to expose everybody to flying, and you're all going to get this basic flying experience, and then from that point forward, if you're medically qualified and you have the grades, they'll slot you into the basic. There's a basic flying program with powered aircraft there, you know, single engine propeller aircraft. So you get the basics of flight there, and then you move on to the, you know, to the 1 year program that the Air Force puts people in. And it's, I mean, flight training is really involved. It takes, you know, it takes 18 months to produce a rated guy who's competent to fly a particular aircraft. There's a year of flying training, basic pilot training, and then you're put into a specialized program with your particular aircraft.
Well, at Notre Dame, one of the guys in our section was a Air Force ROTC guy, and he was constantly shuttling back and forth to the airport in my car to get his, you know, he was on a Cessna or a Piper or something. I don't know if he went on instrument training there or whatever, but he was taking lessons at South Bend Airport.
Yeah, and so the pipelines to get into it used to be multifaceted. You know, the academy had a flying program. There was a program at a place called Hondo Air Force Base in Texas that had a basic flight program for ROTC people, and then they ran another couple of programs, I think, in San Antonio, and so you could get into the program one of several ways. It's much more restricted now, and you know, and Chief, they run off, you know, they divert a group of the cadets off for drone flying. Now, really? You know, it used to be that you would try to get guys who'd gone through flight training and turn those guys into drone pilots because they already had the basic flying skills. They don't do that anymore. Now they take people straight in. The drone program is much more accelerated.
They use from the drone, like on the pinball machine, the last starfighter,
it's something like that. I mean, they put you in and they get you up to training so that you're competent to fly a Reaper or one of the others, and that's a much more accelerated course, and it's, you know, it has a whole different skill set because there's a lot more coordination, obviously, in flying a drone than there is in flying a jet. So,
there's a lot to this. And
When we talk about recruiting shortfalls, you know, we don't train people the way, for example, they train in Russia, where they're just meat grinding people. Here's your gun. They're the bad guys. Here's how you shoot it. Go.
Here's your bullet.
Get them.
Bullet.
Yeah. Yeah. Go. Here's 500 rounds of ammo. Good luck. It takes months and months, and the pipeline for managing, like the Navy, you know, managing some of our more complex weapon systems is very long, and we're a very competent, force in a lot of ways, but we have to have this manpower pipeline.
In terms of the ROTC, now Notre Dame is a small school. I mean, it thinks it isn't, but it is. There's probably 7,000. Actually, people don't necessarily realize that by far the largest Catholic university in the country is DePaul here in Chicago. We're in Georgetown, bigger than Notre Dame, and it's not even close. But they had full Navy, Army, and Air Force ROTC programs in a school that size. I mean, there couldn't have been. Now, when you look at what goes on at like Texas A&M, that looks like it's all Army, or they have all three. Does every school have all three, or people like...
No, it varies. ROTC programs are varied. A&M has a huge ROTC program because they've always been a sort of a quasi-military school, and they're at the core of cadets at A&M is comprised of guys who are going through that military program, but I think the vast majority of them are ROTC, but some of them are not. Some of them are just there to get, you know, be part of this military unit, private military unit organized at A&M.
Can you be a regular student there and not be a part of that?
Yes. Now, you know, private military academies like the Citadel or VMI, you know, most of those guys are ROTC, but a lot of them are not. They're just there to get that 4 years of military discipline and training, and then they go on to something else.
But VMI was that's where what's his name went, right? World War II guy,
Marshall.
Yeah, he went to VMI, didn't he?
Yes.
But isn't the head of VMI, wasn't he always like a general, retired general or something?
Usually a retired officer. Yeah.
And the Citadel is sort of the same.
Same with the Citadel.
Yeah, well, there you go. Hey, what's going on in the around the world? Where do you want to start? it's like, you know, there's a lot of stuff going at once, and it's pretty hard to keep track. I mean, it's now.
Let's talk a little bit about this guy they seized from Colombia.
Hey, can I ask you one question first? I've asked everybody else, so I made a mental note to ask. When you look at what's happened in the market, I'm not going to grill you on that because, first of all, it's pretty hard for anybody to figure out what's going to happen in the market. I'm just happy for my people, everybody's hedged, because I'm not losing a wink of sleep, Lou, and actually we're making some money going back and forth when it goes up and down, but that's for another conversation. But when I see, you know, the basketball values, and I see these numbers are flinging out to a lot of these football players, and I continue, I can't shake the fact that I'm a economist slash cost accountant at the core. And in order for you to put some kind of budget together anywhere, whether it's the military, whether it's a school, whether it's your you know, your house, you have to have some sort of view of the world going forward. And my question is, when granted, Kevin yesterday was very articulate as usual and said most of these football contracts are only 2-3 years, so it's not like you need a 10-year plan to do it, or maybe you would in baseball or something. But I went through you were in Chicago when Seriano was here, right? And I went through the routine of his 5-year career at Chicago when he ended up getting he got this huge contract, right? At a time when, in 2007, when people thought, you know, the future was nothing but roses. And at the end of his career here at Chicago, and he always had a pretty good, you know, he wasn't a superstar, but he was pretty good. And the Cubs essentially, I think, without even knowing it, made the observation that in 5 years, even if he's a, you know, a 5.5 on a scale of 1 to 10, that's what outfielders are going to be making. And it turns out that the last couple of years, he wasn't vilified here in Chicago because he always showed up to play and hustled. But the big bitch against the guy was, he's making too much money, and if we're only giving him $4 million, like you could actually get a, you know, a outfielder for in 2012, we could spend the other, we, the Cubs could spend the other four and other players, and we'd be a better team. So he took kind of the brunt of that. And I actually looked in 2007 when I signed him. 2012, the stock market was actually down, so we had a, you know, a serious pause in economic growth. And I just wonder if on these valuations of some of these teams and what people are paying basketball players and so forth, if the market was to go into a 5-year thing where at the end of 5 years we're at the same spot or lower than we are now, what does that do to all these valuations and contracts? Are people going to be able to hang in there and pay all these money? Is it going to grow every year like it has the last 2 or 3?
For the NFL, let me talk about those deals, because the NFL's in the spotlight right now. The salary cap has almost doubled since the last collective bargaining agreement was signed. It's, you know, it's an astronomical number that when they signed the last CBA, I don't think anybody anticipated. And the salary cap is driven by typically the TV contracts that they sign.
Used to exactly match, didn't it?
I'm sorry?
It used to almost exactly match, right?
Yeah. I mean it was very close. It's still pretty close. But it's, you know, it's a complicated measure because it includes spending that is not necessarily evident to us in terms of the value of the contracts. The numbers that get tossed around on the contracts are the cash payments. And the key in understanding these agreements is it's the cash that's provided, not the actual value of the contract. Because the value of the contract, first of all, in the NFL, they're terminable at any time. And a lot of the delayed or deferred compensation is can be adjusted or is adjusted for cap purposes, so that it can be stretched, it can be compressed, and the value of those deals is really ephemeral, unless you are looking at the amount of money cash that is actually paid to the player, you know, upfront, or that is guaranteed.
Well, the guaranteed part's getting seemingly bigger and bigger. There was a time when you first came on the show that the only thing that was guaranteed was the bonus, right?
Correct. It was unheard of that you would guarantee, you know, future years. I always screw this up, but the kid from Cleveland that they signed, the quarterback, the, you know, Mr. Massage.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Not Jackson. Anyway, the Cleveland quarterback. And I'll think of his name. This is the problem when I get up on 2 hours of sleep.
Lou, you got so much up there, it takes a while to access. What can I tell you?
But that's really, I think it just takes a while to get the cobwebs cleared. Anyway, he signed a contract that was fully guaranteed. And it was complete insanity for that club to do that for that guy.
Not the little guy. The guy was Charlie quarterback, what the hell's name was, the guy coming out of college?
Well, he's the guy that
you guys are behind today. Deshaun Watson's the first one, and that you're talking about Johnny Manziel, football.
Yeah, no, Manziel or Watson is the guy I'm talking about.
Yeah, with Watson was 5 years, $230 million.
Right, all guaranteed. That was an outlier, and nobody, you know, nobody else has been willing to do that. Now, Josh Allen, I think, signed a huge guaranteed deal that I think actually eclipses.
I don't think it's exactly all guaranteed. It's like $250 million, like $240 million guaranteed, or it's almost pretty close.
No, it's a number that eclipses Watson. But yes, it's not fully guaranteed, and it's quite likely if we looked at the language of the contract, there are escape clauses in there for the club. But
$330 million.
Is that total or is that guaranteed?
That's total. I think his guaranteed was 250.
I was going to say 240. 250
is what I recall. Yeah. So thanks, Greg. I'm glad you're adept with the keyboard. I would try to look it up on my keyboard, but I'm almost certainly would disconnect the call.
There you go.
But so everybody looks around and says, okay, fine. You know, his number is guaranteed. Now, What happens if the NFL tanks? The NFL's position is we're not overextended because our contracts, unlike the players' contracts, our contracts are guaranteed. So we can, with confidence, project the value out for these years that we've got these TV agreements, and we can set the salary caps with some confidence out into the future, and project that you'll be able to pay this much to your superstars. What amazes me, Tom, is always contracts like the Dodgers for Otani for
except he's not taking the money, is he?
I'm sorry,
he totally deferred the money, or what?
He did. That's what I find remarkable. I mean, he deferred. What was he taking? Like $2 million or $3 million a year. With a guaranteed payout of like $10 million a year over the next 25 years after he retires.
Yeah, he deferred. It says $680 million.
Well, the guy's got such endorsement money. Where's he going to put it all? Except for now he doesn't have the guy gambling it away either.
But I mean, if you look at that, yeah, I mean, if you look at that, that's all guaranteed. If you're the Dodgers, you're saying to yourself, geez, I really hope the market doesn't tank because we don't have projections out that far, and that's not based on a real thing. So this
was his idea, by the way.
I know. Well, the California tax rates. I mean, this and it's California, good old California, commies. The California tax officials began screaming when they realized that most of that money could go back to Japan with it, and that they wouldn't be able to tax it, and they were trying to figure out some way they could interpret their tax code to latch on to their share of that, you know, however much of that.
Yeah,
is
but also your taxes is on cash; it's not an accrual.
Oh, I know, but that wasn't going to stop them, Tom.
Oh, I know. No. So it's the same thing as trying to get somebody coming in here, Michael Jordan, when he comes into Detroit, they want, and he gets paid for that game, they want the money in Detroit, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's I think Philadelphia was the first place to start that, but it's now common in most of the major cities. You have a portion of your game check goes to the locality in which you're playing.
What did your buddy used to command, the accountant guy?
Robert Raiolo?
Yeah, the guy on the Bears that was injured and didn't play an exhibition game in Indianapolis, and the state of Indiana was after him for it, even he wasn't even there.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, there was a Supreme Court case with a guy from the Steelers, I think, who was protesting the way they were calculating, or no, it was Indianapolis. A player from Indianapolis who was protesting the way they were calculating these numbers and just saying this is an unconstitutional taking by this locality, and prevailed.
He wasn't even there. He didn't go to the game or something, did he? Or some story like that? It was something crazy.
So anyway, long-winded answer to your question. Is it a risk for these teams? It's less of a risk for the NFL because they don't overextend like this. It's more of a risk for baseball, I have not heard of a of an NBA contract that looks like Ohtani's, for example. But you're tossing around huge numbers. The leagues have an obligation, and I've said much more familiar with the NFL. The leagues have an obligation to ensure that their clubs are going to be able to make good on these things, and so they're tied to a revenue stream in the case of the NFL that's predictable and significant.
Well, it is. It is sort of. Kevin mentioned yesterday that the NFL, in an attempt, you know, when I first got the part about the network check equaling the salary cap was from our buddy DeCoach when Cleveland left and became what Baltimore, right? Didn't Cleveland or Modell move the team to Baltimore? Is that now the Ravens?
Yep. Yeah, Ravens. That's how they became the Ravens. Yeah.
Well, the last game in Cleveland was, I believe, what was the announcer? Been around forever. The father, son, the Chip Carey or somebody, and Mike Ditka did the game. Mike Ditka did the color, and as usual, the coach was not as closed mouthed. Maybe as the league wanted him to be. And the guy was it Carey or whoever the other guy was. Said, well, you know, he says he's losing money. And Ditka goes, wait a minute, how the hell do you lose money? He goes, the check you get from the network pays for the whole salary cap. That's if you use it all up. And I'm sure he wasn't supposed to say this. And he goes, that leaves you with your local revenue, you get your local TV, NFL properties, concessions, wherever else you can get, and all you're paying is coaches, insurance, and travel. He goes, how do you screw that up unless you gamble it away, basically?
That may have been close when he was doing that.
Yeah.
It's not the case anymore.
Well, you just said it was pretty close.
It covers it. Yeah, the salary. No, I said the salary cap number is tied.
Yeah.
To the TV contract.
But I think the TV contract check essentially covers the calorie check, or it's damn close.
Pretty close.
I think it's more.
It's probably within 15%.
Okay, I think it's actually more. The money you get from the networks now, but anyway, go ahead.
But the point is that they're gambling. The clubs with these extended long term payments are obviously gambling into the future as to what their revenue stream is going to look like. I honestly don't know if there's a bond somewhere that the Dodgers have you know signed with Ohtani that says, okay, you know, here's the chunk of money that we're going to deposit here into this bond that will ultimately pay out the remainder of your contract.
I'll bet they didn't deposit the cash, Lou. I'm sure they didn't.
I'm sure they didn't, but I don't know if there's some kind of something, you know, quasi contractual arrangement or some other kind of arrangement that commits them or provides him with some kind of security that in fact that money's going to be there. I mean, if I were his agent, I would demand that. But again,
Mets are still paying Bobby Bonilla, even though it's another owner.
That's
right.
That's right. And so, you know, you look at those numbers and say to yourself, oh, somebody's very confident about the way the league is going to the way
you know, you know
what go.
You don't. I know I've mentioned it to before, and the listeners remember. You know where that money went. The whole thrust of the Bobby Bonilla thing. You know where to go?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with where you're going.
Well, with the Bobby Bonilla money, the reason why they
Well,
you know where that money went.
I don't have any idea where it went.
The guy Bernie Madoff.
The guy took the money.
Yeah, he got an annuity. The numbers, you know, I'm not exactly sure on the numbers. He essentially got an annuity. Said, I'm not going to pay Bobby Bonilla this money this year or next year or whatever, and I'll push it off, whatever, 20 years, and I'm going to buy an annuity to pay you this per year for 20 years. And Bobby Bonilla says, okay, well, the amount he put down, the implied interest in there was like, I'll give it 6 or 7% he got from someplace. And he took the money, the cash that he should have paid Bobby Bonilla with at the time, and he gave it to Bernie Madoff, who was essentially guaranteeing 15%.
Ugh.
And the guy said, "Well, this is genius. You know, I'll be paying Bobby, you know, $2 million a year, and I'm making $3 million on the amount of dough. So I'm going to make $1 million a year on the interest scalp or the return scalp on this contract." And of course, that money went under, and I think he's no longer the owner. But since the contract is with the Mets, the new owner's on the hook for it, right? Is the way I see it.
I think. Well, I know they're still paying him. I did not realize it, that he had gotten into the Madoff.
Madoff was making what, $12-15 a year, and he probably got some annuity for Madoff for 6 or 7 or something, and he ponied the money up there.
Unbelievable.
Yeah,
unbelievable. All right, real quick, I want to talk about this dude from Columbia University, just because it's a little scary to me that we are basically picking up a guy, even a bad guy, and I think this guy's a bad guy, and deporting him essentially for engaging in what would be, for most people, a protected First Amendment activity. He is, and I don't know if you guys have talked about this. I tried to listen to the show yesterday.
We have not, so I was actually hoping you would.
Tried to listen to the show with Kevin yesterday on the flight home last night, but my download didn't take.
I hate it when that happens.
It does, yeah. An untaken download is a sad thing.
It's a sad day.
So this guy, the move against this guy is you look at the initial charges and the claims that are being made are that we're basically deporting this guy. We've arrested him and are holding him because he engaged in protests that we don't like. Okay. I understand that argument, and that's sort of what it looks like, except that his legal status, it changes all of this. He's not a citizen. He is a green card holder. He was here on a student visa until, I think, a student visa, or I think he stopped being a student in December. So you have and what he's done, what he did, is he, basically was a rabble rouser against Israel and Jews and, pro-Hamas, pro-terror, this terrorist group. Led was the face.
Now, there's a fine line here, because I was totally against the way the Israelis went about this, and it's seemingly me, their sort of disregard for how many people they killed. But I was never pro-Hamas. I've always been pro-Israel. Doesn't mean, so this guy was actually pro-Hamas, we think.
His demonstrations were, and not a, he's identifies as a Palestinian born in a refugee camp in Syria, and he comes in.
That would change your attitude.
Yeah, comes in on a student visa in 2022, and enrolls in Columbia, but he's been a huge agitator. So one of the deals when you come in and you register as a foreigner getting a visa coming into the United States is you are subject to a code, the U.S. code, and this is not a surprise. There are the people coming in under these circumstances are well aware of the limitations in terms of their activities that are placed on them by our immigration system, and one of them is you can't engage in activity that, or support activity that, in the estimation of the government, makes you a national security risk. And the U.S. is taking the position that this pro-Hamas, and it's not just pro-Hamas. I mean, the organization that he is heading and the statements that they've made say, we want to tear down Western civilization.
That's a little extreme.
I believe that's a quote. We want to overturn Western civilization, because he's an Islamist. He's one of the more radical types.
Not the same as we want to invade Greenland and take over Greenland's.
No, no. Overtaking Greenland might be a problem if you're living in Greenland, but it's not a problem there. So these are the rules, and there's a whole body of counseling entities.
Did the dude actually go to school? Do we know if, or did he just hang there?
I think he did get a degree.
Right.
But there's a whole body of counseling centers in New York, and free counseling centers and free programs that counsel people like this guy. Look, you can't be out there screaming down with death to America and death to, you know, Zionists, excuse me, in a way that reflects a desire to overturn or be counter to the U.S. government and its foreign policy. So
that would make sense. Back up a second. What is Colombia like? I mean, before we set this whole thing, is Colombia, this just happened there, or are they some bastion of God knows what politics or whatever? Are they just a regular school? It just happened. Yeah.
No, they're not a regular school. They're an Ivy League school.
Okay.
And they are a bastion of this kind of craziness. And the anti-Semitism that has surfaced at places like Colombia, in large part due to the presence of a radical group of Islamic and students and their supporters, is a real problem. And the, you know, the Jewish community in New York has been agitating for somebody to do something as these guys shut down the campus a couple of times last year.
Oh yeah, I remember that. It was pretty bad.
You know, the encampments and the riots and the, you know, breaking into the buildings, and so the the Secretary of State Rubio, who was handling the immigration side of this, said, "Look, if this guy had applied for a visa and said, 'I'm coming to the United States to agitate in favor of a terrorist organization that we've designated,' and to scream, you know, death to the Jews, we wouldn't have let him in."
Yeah, that's a problem.
And so he's on a visa here. He was on a visa here, and he's in a non-citizen status doing this. We are revoking his privilege of being a visitor, a guest in this country. And that's what they're doing. I don't like it. I understand it, and I understand why they're doing it. It's a dangerous...
Well, the idea that you scoop people up and move them around, and then the way they're doing it, you know, which is sort of a bad thing. But, you know, the only thing I will say is this whole mess, when you see the worst come out of people, it got to the point for me where some people would say any criticism whatsoever of Netanyahu's methods made me anti-Semitic, and nothing could be further than the truth.
No, it's a different... So
I know, he's way behind it, but you know...
He's way past
Did you ever read... I forget where the hell I read it.
Let me put it this way, Tom. If there was a German, to use a stereotypical example, if there was a German student group at Columbia that was marching through the streets screaming, you know, white people, uber alles, get rid of the blacks, get rid of the, you know, the degraded, I mean, all the terrible anti-black, anti-Negro, to use that term, stuff that boiled up in the 1930s and 40s out of you know, Germany. If you had a bunch of people marching through the streets screaming, you know, down with black people, they need to go back to Africa, death to the black leadership, you know, da 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 da. If you had a bunch of people marching through the streets and they were foreigners, they were here on either student visas or here with some other kind of non-citizen status, we would be moving those people out of here without hesitation.
Well, again, off topic only because you drove me there. How close did we come in those years? Because now that the internet is around, you get to see this stuff. You don't have to go down to the library and find it. We had massive things here, massive gardens that were essentially Nazi.
We got an alderman here that burns the flag. What can we do about that?
Well, what I'm saying is
burned the American flag or the Nazi flag?
No, the American flag.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if he's a citizen, it's protected activity.
Yeah.
And he probably got a, you know, some kind of a bonus from the city of Chicago.
Well, but look, we had a...
I don't. There was a sizable element of pro-German sentiment based on what Hitler was doing. There was a huge sentiment in the country to stay out of Europe and stay out of what was happening over there. And you know, that was one of the things that Roosevelt was. I mean, he basically, as far as I could tell, committed impeachable offenses. with his committing us to basically acts of war against Germany.
He had advance
of our being involved.
He had
Lou, have you seen the Sarah Payne podcast with Dwarkesh Patel? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Sarah Payne's the
war college professor, talks about history.
These names are familiar, but I have not.
Yeah, she was saying how Roosevelt was in a real tight scenario until Nazis declared war on the U.S. because they had
without a doubt,
absolutely,
yeah. Because
what he did was patently illegal and dangerous. I mean, the Germans with the Lend-Lease stuff, the Germans could have declared war on us. They had that was. Under international law, that was casus belli, you know, a legitimate reason to declare war. And the greatest miscalculation Hitler made was declaring war on us after Japan attacked.
Well, in his mind, he was tied into it because of the tripartite agreement, right?
He was, but they could have held back, and it would have created huge political problems here.
Without a doubt. But, it's kind of was sort of different world, Lou, in the sense that, I think a lot of the protests here were, you know, and nobody kind of wants to hear this, but Hitler managed to get Germany out of the Depression a lot quicker than we get out of it here. And a lot of people were looking at the essentially economic, or what they thought was the economic progress there, and felt that, I mean, we can say what we want about how people have always been this, you know, America first, we love our democracy and all this kind of crap. The simple fact is that during the Depression, most people didn't think our system was working so hot, right? Because it wasn't. And the idea of an alternative system that appeared to be working better, or people told you was working better, was certainly something where people interested in hearing about, right? I mean, that's why people, I mean, okay, nobody likes communists, I don't. But if we go into a full-ass Depression here, and Russia says we're doing better than you guys, I got to believe people are going to listen, right?
Well, that actually, we've had this discussion recently. That actually happened here. You had thousands of American engineers and other semi-skilled workers head to the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 1930s, especially mainly in the 20s, because they believed in the utopian dream that was being promoted by the communists there.
What was the name when they had the massive rally in Madison Square Garden? They were essentially Nazis, but they never used the term Nazi here. There was another.
Well, there was word for it. Was called the German American Bund.
Oh, they called it that, but they were Nazis. Yeah, okay.
That was the we would call them affinity groups now. That was the Nazi affinity group, and it was riddled with, you know, Nazi sympathizers. But again, I don't think people really understood the depravity that Hitler had unleashed in Germany, unless they were actually living there.
That's what I was just about to say, and you of course spot the get the words out before I can ask him, because you're that bright. Hitler, I mean, the Roosevelt situation, it's kind of not like today. He was privy to information that normal people didn't have and couldn't get, and he didn't really want to let anybody know about it, because then he wouldn't have it. It was, you know, he was aware, way more aware of where Hitler was going and how it was going to envelop everybody, because every time he said give me this, he just went a step further. He was very aware that there was no stopping the guy.
If you read the book by Eric Larson called In the Garden of Beasts, which is based on the diary of, I believe, a Chicago professor who Roosevelt plucked out to become the ambassador to Germany in the early 30s, and who was there writing to the State Department about how bad things were. So you get a picture of the situation there, and this was being communicated back to Roosevelt.
Didn't the guy write a book about that? The guy wrote a book about that, called The Winds of War, right?
Well, I mean, Larson, that's fictional. If you read Larson's book. His is pure historical, and he writes in a very entertaining way. But it's astounding when you read what he was experiencing. This professor was experiencing in Germany, what his family was experiencing, and you know, true to form, his daughter ends up in a series of sexual liaisons with high-ranking Nazis. She ended up, you know, girlfriend of you know, like these SS types, and sort of an astounding turn of events. But anyway, his reports that go back to Roosevelt, and then the State Department hated this guy, you know, because he was not a State Department flunky. But his reports go back to Roosevelt describing this stuff. So yeah, to you know, again, Roosevelt had a window into what was developing there.
That was his huge strength, I think, Lou, Roosevelt. Because you've read this. I'll be brief here. What you just said is exactly what Herman Roch wrote about in The Winds of War, where Pug Henry was the naval attaché to Berlin, right?
Right.
And Roosevelt had him for dinner at the White House. And Pug Henry's like, what in God's name is he inviting me to dinner for? And he did. And then afterward he said, oh, hey, Pug, you got a minute? Which he knew was coming, right? And he said, look, I want you to write every week or 2 weeks or more if you have to, I want you to write me a letter right to me, not through the naval people, not through the State Department. You put it in the diplomatic pouch, and I'm the only person who's going to read it. And you tell me exactly what's going on there. I want to know everything. And in the house that Pug Henry rented over there, he rented from some Jewish doctor, right? Well, every few months, and you might ask yourself, why would a guy rent you his house? Well, he wasn't allowed to stay. He had to go somewhere else and stay in some pogrom or something. And all of a sudden, he ended up selling Pug Henry the house for like nickels on a dollar because they were going to take it from him. Then he sold him his artwork. And oh, by the way, all of a sudden, the next month, he couldn't treat Gentile patients. You know, and all this stuff is getting back to Roosevelt, which is the same thing as what you're talking about. Not to mention, well, the submarine plant is now working two shifts instead of one. All this is getting back to Roosevelt, not through the State Department, and not through... And he probably had 100 Pug Henrys, right? Because that's what Roosevelt was strong at. Maybe he had 200 Pug Henrys. And he's got this cache of knowledge that nobody even knows he has, and he doesn't even want to talk about. So he was stuck, kind of, like you said. I mean, it wasn't like he was just some rabble-rouser. I mean, he wasn't, I don't think.
My thing on Roosevelt is that as obvious as what was happening in Germany was, and he was aware of that, he was either oblivious or sympathetic to what was happening in the Soviet Union. And as it turned out, his organization was riddled with communist sympathizers and in some cases spies.
Well, how much can you do? You had the Japan situation on the one side, the German situation on this side. I mean, we really didn't need a third enemy, do we? I mean, I
know, but by the time, again, by the time you see these people at Potsdam, and I must say, I had the experience of walking through Potsdam a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago.
Potsdam's where?
And sat on the bench that is pictured in that famous photograph of Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt, you know, all sitting together.
Potsdam's in the Mediterranean, right?
Potsdam? No, it's in Germany. East Germany. Eastern Germany.
That's where they were all sitting?
Yes. I literally sat on that bench.
Wow.
By the time Potsdam rolls around, they know what the U.S. knows what's going on, and we don't stand up to the Soviet Union, which was frankly exhausted.
That's because Roosevelt was going downhill, wasn't he?
Pardon me?
Roosevelt was going downhill by that time.
He was, but the people in his cabinet who were the Soviet sympathizers and as I said, in some cases spies. You know, they were getting, he was literally negotiating with the Soviet Union to divide up India, you know, just take it from the British and divide it up. There were all kinds of shenanigans going on. He was not attuned to that, and he should have been.
Critique me on this. He was a guy that, and we've had other presidents since then. They think because of their incredible personal charisma that they're going to change people. And I've got a guy who comes on my show every Thursday, and who's warned me about that, named Lou, and says you're not going to change these people. And he was always sort of under the impression that somewhere along the line the Russians would sort of become like us. And he thought he could somehow change Stalin. Now, Harry Truman was right on this exact same page as Churchill. The guy's a thug. He's always going to be a thug, and I can't trust him. There's a massive difference in those two guys and how they regarded Stalin, isn't there? Roosevelt, yes. And Truman?
Well, yeah. And Truman was not in thrall to a staff that, as I said, were comprised of East Coast intellectual elites, where the Communist Party had made significant inroads in the 1920s and 1930s, much like they did with the UK. And these were the people that Roosevelt relied on, because these East Coast elites were his people. But now Truman comes out of Kansas City, and he's not impressed by any of this.
The only thing I have to keep saying, Lou, and I shouldn't, but the times they were different. I mean, right now, if somebody comes up and wants us to be communists, you look at them and go, what are you talking about? But coming after an 8 or 10 year disaster economically here, and says, I have a new system that's going to work better than this piece of crap you guys have here, this capitalist system that just blew up on you, you're probably going to listen. You may not agree with them, and you may say no, but the atmosphere is different. Let's put it that way.
So I'm going to counter that and say, by the time the early 1930s roll around, we were, at least at the upper echelons of our government, we were well aware of the horrors that were being perpetrated by Stalin in the Soviet Union.
Right, and Hitler probably. He just started.
Hitler hadn't started. Hitler didn't roll until 33. Stalin by 33 was solidifying his power. The pogroms and the exterminations of the private sector farms and the execution of millions and starvation of millions of people in Ukraine had been undertaken. We knew what was going on.
His count of people killed was way bigger than Hitler's, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, Hitler, if you look at Hitler as exterminating, you know, 6 million Jews, the estimate was Stalin, I've seen numbers ranging from 15 to 20 million just in the camps alone, to somewhere north of, you know, 30 million in terms of the ultimate people that were executed in the Soviet Union over the course of his
time. How do you not fall in the trap that the enemy of my enemy is the other guy fighting my enemies has to somehow be my friend, even though he's not really my friend?
We're facing that situation now, Tom.
Yeah, well,
where Trump is negotiating, trying to shut down, and my personal opinion is what you're seeing is a much longer strategic game than we're used to seeing in American foreign policy that's being played out here. I guarantee you, Trump's strategic advisors are telling him, you know, Mr. President, the concern we've got right now in the next 4 years of your presidency is China. You have to deter, we have to deter China, which is a rising power right now. We have to deter them from taking Taiwan. We cannot afford to have armed materials and our allies tied down in a conflict in Europe, which, you know, we're not going to commit the kind of combat power to resolve because we've got a nuclear foe on the other side. We have to be stronger in the Pacific than we do in Europe, and the Europeans are perfectly capable of taking this on. They need to step up, because our focus needs to be over here. And so what I see happening, and all of this plays into what I think are President Trump's natural instincts. He hates war because it's inefficient and it's bad for business. He looks at economic opportunities that are being diverted because of deflected because of what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening in Gaza. So he's saying we gotta be realists on this, get ourselves disentangled from there and turn our attention to the Western Pacific. And so from a strategic perspective, this is the way of doing it. And he is using carrot, very blunt carrot and stick kind of focus with and implements with Ukraine and now I assume with Russia. We'll see what happens with the Russians with this ceasefire proposal. But
if he could pull it off, I'm sure for him, you know that.
Well, that's right. I mean, we'll see what happens. But I think you're seeing the reason he's cozied up a little bit to Putin in terms of we're gonna damage Ukraine. I think he's less focused on the damage to Ukraine and more focused on I want the Ukrainians to do this. And if they don't see that they need to do this,
well,
then I'm going
but that's,
to
that's,
force them.
It's easy to say. I mean, you could have. When did Roosevelt and Churchill meet on the battleships in Iceland? Was that 1940 or whatever the hell it was? Early 41.
Yeah.
You could imagine. Well, I don't know if you could imagine somebody saying, "Hey, the guy with the mustache has all the cards. You got to give him the continent." And by the way, you owe us India for the destroyers we gave you. Well, that would have been one hell of a worldview. Well, I mean, there needs to be some understanding that Zelensky, not the perfect person, that's sort of his country. when you start saying you got to give up half to these guys, it's going to land. I mean, somehow or another, one of my issues with Trump is that he seemingly has zero ability of putting himself in the other guy's mindset. I mean, you talked earlier about this guy from causing all the trouble at Columbia, but when you mentioned something about he was born in a refugee camp, that to me doesn't absolve bad activities. But I actually read a book once, it was more like a long paper about how terrorism and the rest of the world sort of kind of coexist in some way, because the rest of the world, if you were driven out of Israel into some refugee camp in the Baca Valley or something years and years ago, and there were three generations in the place, I don't even know if it's there anymore, the tent cities or whatever. Now, if you're born there and you live that life, the rest of the world has now forgotten about you. They've moved on. But you have no ability to move on because you're still there. You're never going to, your mindset is just different. Because it's sort of like if in the early 1900s, if you were Irish, everywhere you went, you saw the sign, the NINA, no Irish need apply. Maybe 10 years later, everybody else has forgotten it, but you haven't.
I'm not absolving these guys of anything.
I'm just saying that there is a difference in mindset.
I mean, I get the mindset difference, and the short answer is, okay, fine, you can think whatever you want, but here's reality.
Okay, but reality, the reality was Germans had the continent. If we bailed, they had it.
Right. Here's the reality. So we're gonna deal with reality. We're not gonna try to put men in women's sports or any other kind of unreal situation. Here's the way things are working, and here's what we have to deal with. And Trump, the president is not a diplomat. He's not a statesman. He's impatient. He's aggressive. He has a worldview that says, I have the superior bargaining position right now, and I'm going to leverage it. And if you don't recognize it, I have to get your attention so that you do. And that's what happens. That's what happened with Zelensky, and that's what happened in the White House, and that's what happened with us pulling the intelligence. And now we've got their attention.
Well,
so
you
now
you got their attention, but you've been the person. We got to go to break here a little. You've been the guy who's told me for years. Maybe the transaction today is to cough up half of Ukraine to the Russians and make the Ukrainians deal with that by cutting them off, all the other stuff. You've been the one that said, okay, Trump, it's 8 years from now, they're going to want the other half. You're not there anymore, Trumpy.
Well, and
Orange
and
Man, as people call me, you're not there. How do you stop that?
Yeah, well, and that's the key. If we recognize that, if we shut down the fighting, we stabilize Ukraine with an unacceptable deal that they don't like, but with the understanding that the Russians will come back, and I think we do that, then we our move is with the Europeans to say, all right, fine, we're now going to bolster Ukraine. to such an extent that if the Russians decide they want the rest of it and try to come in, now it's real war with NATO.
I don't, and then all of a sudden it's 6 years from now and the same attitude's now. Why the hell do we want to go to war for Ukraine? Same thing.
Well, it may be. But it'll be, if they try to take the rest of Ukraine, the incipient threat to Europe becomes that much clearer.
How many times did Chamberlain tell that to Hitler?
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, I understand.
Well, but anyway, again,
what's the reality?
Get some rest, bud. You sound good. I mean,
I'm headed back to bed.
You guys got massive amounts of snow last week or something, didn't there? Or is it coming this week or something?
Big snow up in the mountains. Nothing here in Denver.
What's the snowpack? Is it good for Lake Mead?
It's about 90% of normal.
So not over the top. Not a big year. Not a big plus for Lake Mead. Just okay.
Say again.
Not a big plus for Lake Mead. Just an okay year.
No. Average year.
All right, but SP Futures right, up 23. NASDAQ Futures up 117. We're going to a quick break. We'll be right back.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Lone Rock Bank Stocks and Jacks, I'm Tom Howell. We have Greg Pappas on the board and contributing. We have S&P Futures down 21. NASDAQ Futures up down 109. Before we get to Wayne here, Greg, what are you making of this? It seems like here's what I'm seeing. Wayne, hang on for a sec, bud, or opine in. It seems like we have this idea, and we have it here. I mean, because obviously I'm managing money for a lot of people. We have this here that you have to kind of fear the upside, because this idea that for the last 15 years the market, every time it goes down, you have to look for the spot when it's going to pop right back up, that whatever the issue is somehow gets revolved. And most people feel that some sort of reversal of policy on tariffs and other things would let the market essentially pop right back up, maybe not to where it was, but maybe pretty close. And I'm sensing that there's some fundamental changes here, that maybe that's not exactly true, but I'm not ready to just lob a whole bunch of short calls on people's positions either, Greg. What's your read from the future side? And we'll get Wayne's read there in a second. What do you think? Is this market down here ready to pop up at a moment's notice on a change of policy that no, we don't need no snake and tariffs? Or is it down because it's down, it's going to stay down?
I mean, I personally, I kind of look at the, when you try to check the winds, I look at Apple and Nvidia, and more recently I think Tesla's had a lot of volume. But Apple, 215 or 216, that's down, what is it? It used to be 250. So yeah, we've come off, and if Apple stays down and keeps going down, then I think we're going to have a problem. Or if Nvidia, the leader of everything, keeps dipping, then yeah, we might have an issue, because most of everything seems to follow them, especially they lead the indexes. So gonna have an issue. Maybe if you're individually picking stocks, you might be having a better time, but if you're just doing indexes and or futures on the indexes, you have to watch those pretty carefully, because those are such heavy weightings.
It was like 2000 when five stocks were 45% of the indexes.
Yeah.
No, Wayne's the guy who remembers 2000.
But there's plenty of premium. I mean, if you have some cash and you're using it, meaning either selling insurance in terms of puts or calls, or if you have them to sell, now's the time.
Well, did you see the straddle in the queues yesterday at 1:30, and the stuff that closed last night was like over $4.
Yeah,
and that's a tough buy.
And not to say, you know, get short premium, but that's mostly, you know, professionals.
Yeah.
But if you have it, I couldn't think of a better time to lower your cost basis and or, you know, sell out of. you have some of the protection for stuff like this when it happens.
Well, if you're in a covered writing strategy, that's for sure. Wayne, how are you, buddy? Thank you for calling in.
Oh, no problem. Hey, I've got a Tesla to sell you on the White House lawn.
What is it? Are you? You're in Florida. Are we getting any of the Tesla vandalism up here, Greg? I've heard it's going on someplace where people running the dealer's lots and keying them and stuff and all that kind of crap. Is that? I hope that's not happening here or where you are. Like, that's crazy. I mean,
there was a note left on one of my neighbor's Teslas the other day. He posted it on a message board for the neighborhood. It said, "You look like a Nazi." And
God.
So, I mean, my neighborhood's, quote, tolerant. So that was pretty funny.
I'm
fighting on the message boards.
Well, you know, there's people, of course, that love the guy. And, you know, I try and have my finger on the pulse of America, Wayne, like you obviously did when you were a reporter and stuff. People get a little rankled when a guy who managed to get $9 million from the government or from government largesse is going to make it all back by firing your ass.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, I probably from my days as a reporter, I did watch part of that, whatever that was on the White House lawn the other day. It looked like a Tesla car lot. But Trump goes up to one of the cyber trucks, and he, you know, he bangs on the side of it with his hand, and he says, "Oh, that's a beautiful design, I'd like to get in it, but the Secret Service won't let me." I caught on to that statement because, you know, now, first of all, why would the Secret Service say you can get into the Tesla over there, but you can't get into that Cybertruck? Well, there's been all kinds of cases where people in Cybertrucks get locked in, they can't get out, and even horrifically, they had three people, one caught fire, and they burned up inside because they couldn't get out. So if that was supposed to be advertising for the Cybertruck, you know, on behalf of Tesla, somebody needs to tell him he's fired.
How do you, I mean, this is, we talk once in a while, Wayne, we don't want to go off on it too much, is that a lot of what you see in this country is, I don't know if it comes from the top or the bottom, but a total disdain for any kind of law. To me, the Cybertruck, do they sell it with the windshields unlawful in Illinois? You're not supposed to have anything tinted out that much. That's the way they come out. How do you sell something illegal, for God's sake?
Yeah, and I've seen some in my neighborhood, and to put it mildly, that I've seen them run red lights. I've seen them make illegal turns. So you got to wonder about the people that are driving them. And of course, Elon Musk, he keeps sending out on his former Twitter that he's sick and tired of people referring to the Cybertruck as the swastika car.
Well, the thing is, but ugly.
It is. Well, you know, apparently there's a feeling that he ripped off the design from two, I guess they were 1970s sci-fi, 1970s, early 80s sci-fi movies, one being Blade Runner and the other one being Star Wars, that they look like some of the vehicles in both those movies. So we haven't seen any attempt to...
Well, if you put anything in a wind tunnel, it kind of comes out the same way. It comes out like that flat shape, or it comes out like a teardrop shape. One of the two. I mean, everything in a wind tunnel comes out the same. I mean, it kind of looks like was a guy from the one that was in Back to the Future. What the hell is that thing? Was it a stainless steel car?
Oh, the DeLorean. The DeLorean.
Yeah, it has a little bit of look like that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I can't. When I was very young, I used to really love cars, Wayne. When I was like 8, I could tell you every car on the street. Now I can't tell you any of them. They all look the same. Of course, yeah, I was more interested when I was 8, but.
I mean, looking at that thing, I think I'd rather drive one of those Pacers, if you remember.
Oh, God. You know, I got to. Well, this is not from. I shouldn't say this on the air, but I will. Those Pacers. I don't know where the hell I was when. It was a long time ago. God, we must have just started going out. I was at River Oaks, right where the lady almost got shot last week, or did get shot. You know, get a load of this. The guy who's the. Have you heard about the girl getting the lady getting shot in the parking lot at Walmart? It probably made it down to you. 65-year-old lady gets blasted in a Walmart parking lot. Turns out the engineer in the building was doing a weekend job down there with his son, and he went in to get something in the Walmart, and the son was in the car, and he heard shots go off, and the kid had a duck under the dashboard. He's right there. And people think it doesn't affect them. It sort of does. Anyway, we're there, and there's this Pacer, and they were the most ugly cars. These four ladies come out. Greg, how can I say this politically correct? Four spatially challenged ladies, shall I say. Big girls. They come out, they open all four doors. You couldn't have done this if you'd done it 50 times, Wayne. All four of them landed on the seat at the exact same second. The car just collapsed. I'm sitting there. If I'd have had that thing on a phone and knew how to take a film, that thing would still be viral. It was
tough on the shocks.
Okay, the whole car just like almost melted. You couldn't. It was almost like they practiced it. Anyway, I have a question for you. We've been kicking back and forth on. And I thought maybe my buddy Wayne actually has an insight into this. This week, somebody was telling me, one of the listeners was telling me about his Eliquis, which is, you know, the same price as Xarelto, the newer blood thinners, even though they've been around for 15 years or so, and how the guy's on Medicare, and it still costs him, the total tab last year for a year of the guy being on Eliquis was like $7,000, and the list price is $690, I think Medicare gets it for $590 or something. So whatever, say 600 times 12 is what? $7,200. And so, you know, he had to pay half with all the different deductibles, and Medicare paid half. And now we're talking about, from what they say on the internet, you know, it costs $18 a year to make Eliquis for somebody, same thing for Xarelto. Now, it seems to me, and Carl's always talking about this on the show, if you look at the federal budget, and oh, by the way, also don't let me forget the ACSU, we've blown through $1 trillion deficit already after 5 months. It's never happened before. I don't know if you looked at the monthly Treasury statement that came out yesterday, but it was sobering, or it came out the day before. How much of a tick on a dog? I mean, Trump appears somewhat fearless at going after the people he wants to go after, usually the weaker people, in my opinion, but don't worry about that. What is it even possible, as abrasive as he can be, and or I'll say as fearless as he can be, is it even possible in a 4-year time for him to make any kind of headway? Because I don't see how the hell Medicare pays $3,500 times 40 million people over on this thing over the age of 65, and this is just one of them. How the hell you're gonna get that back by laying people off in the Department of Education? I mean, we know where the numbers are, and yeah. So far we're not going anywhere near them, and the Republicans never have, and the Democrats really never have. So how long can we bitch and moan about other money we're spending when we all know where the big number is, where the big gorilla in the room is, and we can't touch it? How powerful are these people, I guess is my question.
Well, I think the jury's out on whether they're touching Medicare.
I'm not talking about Medicare. I'm talking about the costs of Medicare.
The cost. Well, he's done a number on the Health and Human Services runs, you know, the Medicare, Medicaid programs. And That department is a shell of its former self.
Okay, man. Stop. I'm not talking about getting rid of people in the department, which he appears perfectly willing to do. What I'm talking about is the actual costs that people are spending are not for those people. I mean, if you get rid of the whole department, you're talking 0.001% of the budget. But if you're talking about Medicare drug costs, it's way more than that. I mean, that's where the problem is. It's not in the people.
Sure. And he has a Prime Minister of Ireland, Michael Martin, into the Oval Office yesterday, and he's complaining about how Ireland stole all of our pharmaceutical companies, which was a flat-out lie. The pharmaceuticals in Ireland that produce Botox and Viagra, among other things, they own the patents on those drugs. They're not American drugs. They're Irish drugs. So he's threatened the same thing with Denmark. They make Ozempic and another one, I forget what it is. They own the patent for that. They've been producing it in Danish plants since the drug was first invented. So, you know, when I saw a thing the other day, you know, it was a sort of a meme, and it's Biden kind of smiling at the camera, "Do you miss me yet?" Biden was trying to negotiate better deals for Medicaid and Medicare to purchase these drugs, because the same drugs, you go to Canada and look at the prices there.
Well, but exactly my point. When he said that when he was still coherent, 3.5 years ago, and one of the drugs that were on the list were the blood thinners, Eliquis and Xarelto.
Oh, sure.
And 3.5 years later, he did nothing. Now, my question is, are they so in like a tick on the dog that it's impossible?
Well, Big Pharma is one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington, and they carry a lot of clout. So we know who butters this guy's bread. It's the billionaires, and maybe soon trillionaires. So unless we had an administration that was interested in actually lowering drug prices, I don't see any near-term solutions.
Well, a couple of Fridays ago, actually, and some we do it a couple other times too. But if you look at the budget, which, like I said, I got it up here. I don't know if you saw this. This is pretty friggin' scary. Where am I here? Where we start in October, right? October and December, it's 5 months the way I count. $1.1 trillion in the hole already, Wayne. What in God's name? Last year, we were $1.8 trillion the whole year. So we're talking about $1.8 trillion. Wait a minute, how are we getting here? Small print. $1.892 trillion we're taking in, and we sent out $3 trillion. So we're talking, we're 40% in the hole every month. And if you look at the, as I'm paraphrasing Carl's, Social Security, which they're going to go after by trying to fire people and do that kind of crap, but the simple fact is, Social Security's fairly close. You could adjust one more year up and raise the tax by 0.1%, and you're probably covered. I mean, my numbers might be a little off, but you're pretty damn close. The rest of the budget, you're not all that bad either, but the Medicare, Medicaid part is 40 or 45% is all that you get for Medicare stuff. And the hole is right there. And then the issue is, I mean, you can't, whether or not it's the government paying it or not, I mean, I don't know if you listen to Kenny Polcari on the show on Wednesday. Kenny, fortunately, is doing great from what I understand. He's taken some of these new, you see the stuff on TV. It's the drug that helps you fight the cancer yourself, in addition to the chemo, the combo pack. They advertise it on TV a lot. $50,000 a treatment. Now, if it costs $5,000, I don't want to be paying $50,000. Wayne, I'm thinking if I pay you $15,000 or $20,000, that should be good enough. That's just me. We can't continue to do that. Now, I don't see, you know, the Democrats made, in my opinion, again, this goes back a ways, made a really, really stupid decision by ramping Obamacare through just on their own votes. Whatever that is, it's big enough to be bipartisan. Otherwise, you end up with, for the next 20 years, the other party just chipping at your solution as being not good enough or being horrible, which in some senses it is. But they're never going to help you, and they're never going to come up with their own system. I don't think the medical... I mean, Trump can go after all these people he doesn't like, but if at the end of 4 years, there isn't some kind of fix on the cost side of medical care, I think we go under, Wayne. I honestly do. I mean, I don't see how...
I agree.
Front and center.
I agree with you. I mean, the... Which is why, you know, you hear a lot of stories about Canada. Oh, I had to wait 8 months for heart surgery. A lot of that is hyped by the nefarious groups, not only in Canada, but the Heritage Foundation, places like that in this country, you know, because they say, oh, it's socialism.
By the way, what do you think? How long do you think you got to wait here?
I don't know why we can't have a system like they have there. I've said this forever. I remember Howard Dean in 2004 when he was running for president. He was governor of Vermont, a state that borders Canada. And he said, I just don't understand why we can't have a system like they have not far from where my state house is in Vermont. And, you know, that was one of the things that really buoyed his campaign that year before the, you know, shotgun microphone caught him yelling about we're going to go to this state and that state after the Iowa the Iowa caucus disaster for him. But I don't understand. See, people think that the Canadian government runs their national health. They call it national health, but the Canadian provinces actually run their own individual healthcare systems. Now, they're under attack in places like Alberta, where this woman who's premier, Danielle Smith, she actually favors annexation of Canada to the United States. She's also destroying or trying to privatize the Alberta healthcare portion, Canadian national healthcare system. And her poll numbers have dropped unbelievably. And if she held an election today, she'd lose. And taking her place would be the Social Democratic, New Democratic Party. So, you know, saying you're not going to do something about healthcare for people is not a politically wise move.
Well, he was not my client, Wayne, but he was a lot of people became clients of the place, PTI Securities. I'm going to say 10, 12 people, which is a lot in one chunk. And they all were investment in this. It was, I don't know, hopefully you've never had the pleasure, but if you go in and say, you know, if you have indigestion or whatever it is, first thing that happens when you go to a hospital and they think you might have some kind of heart issue is they draw blood and they look for the enzymes that, if your heart has had some damage, the enzymes essentially pop up in the blood, correct? I mean, I'm sure you know that. Hopefully it's never happened to you. And it takes a while. And the machines they have, I say a while, it takes, you know, an hour or two. I'm not sure exactly how long it takes, but it takes a little while. And the machines are, you know, probably Merck and somebody else. And, well, this guy in Toronto had invented a machine the size of whatever you want to call it, almost like a little coffee pot, that you could take a quick blood swipe, throw it in there like in an ambulance or something, and get the reading right away, which was, you know, was like 95% accurate. So you could actually, in the ambulance going to hospital, say Wayne's in here, he's having some chest pains, but he's not showing any of these enzymes, or the enzymes are to the chart, you better be ready to open the guy up the second he walks in the door. You could have that. It made all the sense in the world. And by the way, it was real cheap. So all of a sudden, the guy, you know, can't get he needs another test, another, you know, another set of emergency rooms, and he's running out of money. When all these people that came here had bought stock in this company. Anyway, I go up to see this guy. And it turns out that he had sold his marketing rights to Merck just as a way to get some money.
Right.
Well, Merck, of course, totally tables the whole product. It never went anywhere. It's the usual BS. Well, yeah. Meanwhile, I'm staying at this real nice hotel. I go down and I'm thinking, all right, well, what am I going to do now? So I sit at the bar. Well, what do people do? Guy sits next to me. We start talking about healthcare. He knew a lot about healthcare, and he said the Canadian system is both better and worse than the U.S. He goes, if you're in a rural area like in the U.S., it's probably very equivalent. It's essentially like a big HMO. And I don't know if you ever were in an HMO, but if you have a preferred, you know, a PPO like we've always had, and, you know, to be blunt, I know a lot of people, okay, from the trading floor and other places. If me or somebody I know, or maybe somebody you know, has an issue, probably I'm going to call up a friend of mine who's a doctor and say, who's the right guy for toe surgery? And maybe he'll help me get me in quicker than somebody else. And that's what happens if you're live in a big city with all kinds of big universities around hospitals. You get this kind of care. Most people, if you have an HMO, you're going to go to the doctor that the firm tells you to, or the insurance company tells you to, say, hey, I hurt my knee. Well, doesn't look like it's that bad. How about give it a few weeks? Yeah, well, you understand, my son needs to play halfback for this team in 3 weeks. He needs a scope. No, your son doesn't get ahead of somebody else. By the way, we'll make you an appointment at the orthopedic guy 3 weeks from now. There's a process that is kind of frustrating.
Sure.
But which the Canada system is. You don't just get to go ahead of the line of all the other people in for your arthroscopic knee surgeries because you need to play halfback in high school. Now, granted, if it's your kid and it's your knee, you want to be in the first line, right? We get that part. But if not, but it is a little bloated, probably like ours. And, you know, I challenge you, if you live in Danville, Illinois, unless you happen to know somebody at the University of Illinois, you're not getting to the best orthopedic surgeon in a week, are you? I don't think so. You'd be lucky to ever find a guy.
Oh, no.
So, I mean, it's, you know, you judge our medicine whether you can access the top of the food chain, and we don't worry so much about the people who can't, right? So if you look at the Canadian system versus ours, you'll find less, everybody who's going to have a baby's covered. I think the amount of deaths at birth over there are a lot less, aren't they, than here? So
yeah,
in some parts it's way better. In some parts, it's, if you need, I mean, I think people, this guy told me that if you do need a chemotherapy treatment that they don't have in Canada, they ship you to Detroit and they'll pay for it.
Now, that's right. That they do. That is absolutely correct. And so, you know, there are these horror stories. Oh, my husband waited and waited for heart surgery, but he died. You know, a lot of that is hype. A lot of that is coming out of, like I say, these right wing think tanks in the United States that don't want any sort of government subsidized medical care. So, you know, yeah, you hear those horror stories, and, you know, occasionally you'll hear a Canadian say, oh, I have to have this and I have to have that. But they eventually get what they need, whether they, go over into, you know, from Niagara Falls to Buffalo. They get the services.
Well, you know, we have had this argument discussion all the time with our Tuesday guest, Professor Helsner, and he's a real free market guy. And the interesting part there, Wayne, is I keep trying to tell him that as much of a free market guy he thinks he is, I'm more of a free market guy. Hell, I traded on the trading floor for 20 years. How much more of a free market guy can you get? But I also am very, I won't say knowledgeable, but observant of the fact that once government does anything to make somebody a monopolist or give somebody protection here or somebody else there, the rest of the place can't be competitive anymore. If you're going to give out 18-year patents with no riding herd on any of the costs you do for any of this stuff, the insurance company can't can't do it on your own. We had a client, long deceased, I think, but he was, when we first started, he was our biggest client in 1991. The guy owned a big, some kind of a factory in Indiana. And what he did was, said, we're not going to pay an insurance company for day-to-day stuff. We're going to get Lloyd's of London, and we're going to get a huge cap on this thing in case somebody has a baby that, you know, needs care for the rest of their life. That's like your most, your biggest horror story is somebody who's paying, is a handicapped kid, basically, because you have to take care of them for years and years and years, which you want to. Because generally, heart thing is not that big of a deal. Cancer can be for a while, depending on how much the chemo and stuff is. But anyway, he said, we're going to have a cap on this, and we're just going to, if you go to the doctor, you're going to write a check. We're going to get the middleman out of here. And he saved a boatload of dough for doing that over like a 10-year period. However, now, since hospitals and insurance companies are sort of in cahoots here for some reason, even though there's been a, you probably could rattle them off, a couple of Supreme Court decisions that say they can't do it and they keep doing it. Now, Trump could change that tomorrow, but he won't. If you go to a hospital from PTI and get an appendectomy, it might be, we have to pay two or three times as much as the insurance company has negotiated, which, by the way, is a blatant disregard of the Clayton Act, the Robinson-Patman Act, you name it, yet they get away with it. So the idea now, the insurance company, you're not buying really insurance, you're buying the network, you're buying their price, which is totally different than you and I might want to design a system. Am I correct?
Oh, sure. And the essence of Obamacare was purchasing into an exchange, which is basically spreading the risk out for people who are still in the workforce or who need medical care, but not maybe long term like somebody who's retired.
Well, and what do you think about this? I mean, when it all kind of started, I don't know exactly when it started, but the idea that healthcare is deductible on taxes for a company but not for a person, that started to me, that's one of the starts of the whole mess, that an individual has to pay it after tax and where a company pays it before tax. It's kind of screwed up in my mind. I mean, yeah. It either should be one or the other, right?
Yeah, I think it would be much better, of course, to have like Medicare. It comes out of Social Security. A lot of people don't know that.
Well, it doesn't come out of Social Security. It comes out of an additional payroll tax.
Right. I mean, the Medicare premiums, I'm on Medicare, but a portion of my Social Security.
That's just to make sure you pay.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's like withholding your taxes instead of hoping people still have the money at the end of the year.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. I just had people our age, of course, have to have that thing they now just call the procedure every 5 years. I just had it yesterday. And I've had four of them. Two done by the VA and two done by Medicare. I got to say that they're, except for anesthesia, the VA keeps you somewhat lucid during the quote-unquote procedure, where Medicare, they knock you out completely. So, but I got to say that the system, I was very impressed. Maybe the first one I had with the VA wasn't so good. That was done up in Washington, D.C., but the rest of them, I thought, I'm very impressed with how the hospitals run that. It's almost, I thought it's very professional. And
How do you know you were out?
Yeah, well, I didn't. The last thing I knew is that the doctor came in and he's starting to tell me what kind of anesthesia they're gonna be using, next thing I know, I wake up afterwards. And I said, hey, what was that powerful concoction? And the nurse said, well, that's the same stuff that Michael Jackson was using when he croaked.
Oh, God. Well, you know, Dr. J's dad was a transplant surgeon. I remember him telling me, I'm not going to kill anybody. The anesthesia's guy, he's the guy who's going to kill somebody. I don't think doctors, whatever, but you know, it is. At some point, though, when you get older, you don't want to be put out very much. It's of course you're only out for what, 20 minutes, half hour.
Yeah, you know, I have no idea. It's really something. I have to say though that the whole procedure about, you know, when you check in and, you know, they, you know, of course there's that prep stuff, but you know, they go through everything, and of course my big issue was, you know, because this was being done under Medicare, and I've got a Medicare Advantage thing, which there are pluses and minuses, but for something like that, which is like recommended by the Medicare Advantage doctor, I don't have to pay any.
Well, there's a, you know, a long line of research that says if whatever procedure you're getting, this one or another one, wholesale price measure flat in February, and everybody thought it was going to go up. So I think we got to worry about the next month one, but next month employment too. But this month we seem to have skated through a lot of this stuff. It has not moved the futures at all. We're still down 950. As if we're just 60, maybe we're up a little bit. But, I mean, we did a, you know, one of the classes I had in grad school, the guy was doing, so he actually got a grant from the government, Wayne, to do some comparisons between hospitals using mathematical models, which is kind of really hard to do because a lot of what happens is subjective. You know, if you walk out of the hospital, your doctor was wonderful. If you're not, the guy sucked, right, or something. I mean, we don't really know. I mean, you and I, if we had an appendix out, just as an, you know, we would know if the guy was a hack and needed 15 stitches to close the thing, or he was, you know, a genius and he used 5. How would we know? All we know is appendix is out, and a few weeks later we're healed, right? I mean, I guess if you got a bigger scar. Matter of fact, there's a guy I met. He was on a trading floor, and this is what happens when you were on the board and stuff, Wayne. All these people knew my name, and all I knew was their badge, right? So I meet this, I go into the local saloon, and the guy's in there, and he goes, hey, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. We have a long conversation with him. And there's a guy here in Chicago that's like Mr. Hip, and he's a Rush. I don't know the guy's name, and if I did, I wouldn't say it. But if you're on Medicare, he wants a $25,000 check from you before he'll do you if you're on Medicare, right? So, but allegedly, he uses an arthroscopic method to put in your hip. So the guy ponies up to 25G, goes there, gets done, and he's into rehab. He goes, you know, and we're in the locker room after rehab, and there's three other guys there with the hips. And he goes, my scar was twice as big as theirs, and they used the other procedure. He goes, what kind of BS was I getting fed for my 25G? How would you ever know? I mean, if you walk out, you're happy, right? How do you know whether the guy did a good job or a bad job as long as it works?
Right, right.
But well, what kind of a fight? You know, people were bitching in a lot of states a few years ago about term limits, right? And, you know, they were catching fire. They never really got anywhere, but they were catching fire. And I was reading some stuff, actually a listener sent me, that some of the big lobbyist companies that use a lot of lobbying money, which are a lot of them the big pharmaceuticals. It used to be Fannie and Freddie were the biggest, right? But now it's a lot of it's the bigger companies, medical companies, and how they were identifying people they thought had talent, like say in the Illinois State House, that might run for representative or senator someday, and they were already giving them contributions. All they did in case, you know, the Nancy Pelosi's and the McConnell's of the world got booted out earlier, they were already going to prime the pump for the young people coming in. I don't know if you ever heard anything like that, but that they were actually contributing to people lower down the chain, thinking the idea is or one of these days they might be a big shot, and they already got them.
Oh, yeah, it's no different than, you know, the NFL with their scouts that go out and, you know, go to colleges. And later on, I heard a friend of mine was a high school football coach in Northern Virginia, in Arlington, Virginia. And he coached his high school team. And he said there was an NFL scout that showed up at that. And so I guess if they do it, we can expect the politicians and the political money donors to do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, but how in this world of politics where both sides allegedly hate each other, even though they're all taking money from the same people, I think some of the hate is trumped up, not using his name, but is trumped up just because they think, you know, their people think that they're fighting for you. In fact, I think they're drinking at the same saloons, taking the same checks, but that's just me. How could you start, you know, if Trump walks into Congress like he did last week and say, hey, we're taking these drug companies. Nobody's paying $1,000 for, you know, the fatso shot when it costs $5. It's not happening. We can't do that going forward. We're gonna break that down. If it means we're gonna drop the medical patents down to 6 months or a year, whatever it is, we're gonna do it. How big of a fart in church do you think that lands? I mean, none of these guys want to be on his side, do they?
Well, easier said than done, because, for example, the Food and Drug Administration has also been basically ransacked by Musk's Doge guys. And then the issue becomes a drug safety. Is this stuff, you know, safe? I mean, I wouldn't put it past Robert Kennedy Jr. to start saying that, you know, well, if you got the flu, we're certifying leaching as a cure. You know, leaching, of course, is when they used to put leeches to draw blood.
What do you mean used to? They still do.
Well, some people, I guess.
No, I mean it's used in high end medicine.
Yeah. Well, I mean it's certainly isn't going to draw out, you know, pneumonia. That, by the way, that helped kill George Washington, because he had pneumonia, and they applied leeches, and what they did was they drew so much blood out of him that he basically died of organ failure.
Really?
Yeah.
I actually know a person. Talk about medicine going awry. Terrific lady I knew from college. I knew her husband, boyfriend, girlfriend back in those days. And she had some sort of an issue. She had, the basal cell stuff on her nose. And she was going to some doctor in a smaller town. Don't worry about it, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. Until finally, wow, you better start worrying about it. And guess what? It's so big of a mess, I can't even help you, type of thing.
Yeah.
Sent her off to the Cleveland Clinic or someplace like that, some major place, and somebody had to totally, essentially, take her nose off and reconstruct it.
Hmm.
And when that happens, and you recreate all the blood flow, I'm no doctor, but I've done a couple people's toes and whatever, that getting the blood into the place is easy. Getting it out through the veins is the trick.
Yeah.
Right away. So what you do is leeches are very good at essentially sucking blood. And what it does, they even out the flow for a few days until the veins catch up with the arteries, allegedly.
Right.
I mean, this is not, don't even think of me being a, she had to have these things hanging from her nose. And you know what, Wayne? You look at her today, you'd swear she never had a problem.
Now, I was going to bring
terrific.
Up...
She looks terrific.
That on the, you know, for wounds, especially battlefield wounds, they have been known to use fly larvae. Because it eats the dead, the bacteria and whatnot in a wound. And they've been used... They use that beginning, in wars in the 19th century. So, I mean, I'm not saying we have no place in medicine for our insect friends, but
how would you going to tackle this? You've been around a long time. How would you do it? Would you start with the patent laws? How would you? I mean, the thing that the biggest bitch basically about Obamacare is that all they did was move the shells like in the street game. They didn't address the cost at all. And oh, by the way, I think you probably know this number. While they were fighting about it, how many insurance companies combined? Was it like 100?
Oh, sure.
So I mean, we end up with now two sets of cartels, and we never addressed the cost of it. All we're doing is deciding who pays, the government, the insurance company, the person. We keep shifting like the little game on the street, you know, where the guy puts the pebble under the three hats.
Yeah.
If you were going to actually address the cost, how would you do it? Does it start with patent laws?
Well, I think certainly Joe Biden's jawboning of the pharmaceutical companies helped bring the price of insulin down to $35. Now it's way up to where it was before. And I think when you use the bully pulpit of the White House, now I'm afraid that the bully pulpit will never be effective ever again. No matter who the future president will be, because the bully pulpit has now been given such a bad name and made such a really a joke. But in the past, as we saw with insulin, I think it can be done. And now the idea of purchasing from Canada, that I don't know why that these proposals are advanced. And then nothing happens, and it's got a big. It's got to be.
But the problem. The problem is not. The problem is not. You've got XYZ drug company. They're selling the crap here at $400, and they're selling it in Canada at $80. That's the problem. It's not. Yeah. It's not because the idea that it's somewhat short-sighted to say, okay, we'll just buy it through Canada. And the drug company's saying, well, that's not happening. Now Canada's going to pay $480. It's a solution that goes nowhere. It's fine for you or me to run across the border and get it there, but there's no way Medicare is going to get the same.
There's got to be a way to get rid of go for the wholesale price. There's got to be a way to get it without going through these, people that tack on their profit. Now it's fine to make a profit on selling stuff, but in a case like that, I think whoever Canada is buying it from, and they may be manufacturing. I think they do manufacture it there. Now I understand that if you're going to say, well, we can get it even cheaper from India, then I say, well, wait a minute now. I mean, what kind of oversight do they have in India for making sure, first of all, that the factories are, up to standard?
And have you ever, sorry to interrupt, but do you know any, I'm accusing you of this, we both know a lot of people that are on various kinds of prescription drugs. I mean, it happens when people get older, right? Do you know of people, I do actually have a few that have gone from the regular drug to generic and have had, A, it doesn't work as well, and B, it actually has caused some problems that are made in other places. Yeah. Have you come across anybody who's had that issue?
I have not, but I wouldn't be surprised. And that's why I'm very concerned about what's happening to the FDA, because that's where they would test, make sure, well, if this is a generic, is it doing the same thing as the actual brand name? I've been taking Jardiance, which is, this diabetes, supposedly it's a miracle pill. I know people are using it for weight loss, but the VA has given me finally, I guess they were forced to do a generic. And from what I've been told by my doctors is that the generic is just the same as Jardiance. It's just that it's not a little pill. It's a little bit larger, but it does the same thing.
Yeah, I've known a couple of people that, unfortunately, are on some thyroid medication. Evidently, they have big differences between the generic and whatever the regular one is. I don't know what the regular one is, but I don't know if I'm gonna. Well, I shouldn't say this, but do I know that the plant in India is as clean as the one here or China? I mean, I don't know who's checking it.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's why, you know, so there's this big push to get rid of the regulatory agencies. Now, yeah, I realize that people have had problems with some of them, but there's a reason why we have them, because they were created to solve a problem in the past. The FDA, for example, not only just you know, drugs, and they had to have some means to police all the quackery that was out there, you know, especially at the turn of the last century, and but also food safety. It's amazing how many people were buying tainted food back in the late, you know, 1800s into the early 1900s, and that's why the FDA was established, and many of these regulatory agencies were created by Republican administrations, for example, Theodore Roosevelt. So, you know, it's to me, it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Yeah, we're going to get rid of the regulatory agencies, and we're going to see an increase in, like, cases of measles.
Well, and it's a, you know, it's almost like, you probably can't tell, Wayne, but there is somewhat of a theme to the show. It'd be hard to tell. Actually, my major theme for the show is everything depends on everything else. And if you look between the stories, you find out they're sort of the same story. And when you see the regulatory agencies, they all were a response to something. And over a period of time, do they become obsolete? Do they become bloated? I think the answer to that, like any human organization, that can very well happen. But whenever, I mean, I go back to, you know, I'm a railroad buff. I mean, when you, all of a sudden, you should there be competition in transportation? Absolutely. Do you really need, if you have perfect competition, do you need a regulatory agency? Probably not. Or you need one just to make sure that, you know, the corn isn't tainted, like you say, those kinds of things. But
sure,
you don't have to worry about prices or those sorts of things. Let the market deal with that. You know, and when I was on the trading floor, you didn't have to worry about people trading through stuff at an open outcry thing, because people heard it and they policed it themselves. Now, do you need a regulator in case somebody, you know, tried to scam the system? Probably. You know, but you need some level, but not very much. Well, I mean, I have this argument with Hal all the time. I mean, when you had railroads, the first thing you did was give people a piece of property and say, or a length of property, and say, if you're going to build a railroad, we'll give you this because we need the railroad. Okay, so when somebody does it, there's no competition, there's no roads, there's nothing around it. So all of a sudden, you know, Wayne Matson's got a farm and he goes, hey, I see this railroad here. How about taking my corn to market? Fine. How much?
Well,
how much you got? How much you got?
You know, well, I'm old enough to remember the Interstate Commerce.
Yeah. And what they basically did is because the government essentially had a hand in creating the monopoly, now you've got a problem, okay? You can't have people charging Wayne, you know, $50 for his 50 bushels of corn to go 2 miles when the guy down the road, because there happens to be two railroads close to each other, is charging $50 to go 1,000 miles. So there needs to be some sort of a governor on the monopoly we just created. And once... Now, granted, if you put a road next to it, and we had trucks at the time, but we didn't, and if you did all that stuff and everything was competitive out of the gate, you probably wouldn't need to do any of that stuff, right? But you do. And right now, between the patent system and the insurance companies, there's all kinds of crap going on in this medical area that's gouging money from people. I mean, the idea that... What was the lady who went to jail for the EpiPens? Remember the EpiPens that were $650 a throw? You know how much the you know, my doctor told me how much if you go in and you got a if you're in an epileptic, what do they call it, epileptic, the shock where a bee stings you, what's the name of that,
Martin Shkreli was the guy's name.
Yeah, and you end up, she says the stuff that goes in the shot that I give you is a buck and a half. What are those things, $650? And the weird part, they were invented by the Army to go through clothes.
Right.
So you got somebody else's invention, you got a buck and a half shot, and you put a new cap on the thing, and you get a patent, oh, by the way, there's $650. Well, that's cool. Duh. I mean, and they never really went to jail for overpricing. They went to jail for what? for screwing their shareholders or something?
Yeah, well, he was not what you would call an honest chap.
No, but if he just would have overpriced it,
yeah,
nobody would have cared.
Right.
Right? Or he wouldn't go to jail for that, I don't think.
Yeah, I think he, because of these windfall profits he was making, he started purchasing a lot of things that, you know, brought a lot of attention on him, too.
What's amazing how those guys, even this guy who's now in solitary confinement, the Bitcoin guy.
Oh, Bankman-Fried. He said, apparently he's open for a pardon.
Oh, God. Well, you know, the weird part is all these people, not all, but a lot of them, they somehow have some talent. And they're very successful, then they don't seem to be able to handle it. But here's a guy, I mean, if you look at the Bitcoin, and I, you know, if you're not in the industry like I am, you just look at the price of Bitcoin, you figure all this is easy to do. Well, nothing's easy to do. I'll take 30 seconds here. Bitcoin's trading in Europe, and it's trading in China, or Asia, or some damn place. And they're trading for two different prices. Because you couldn't buy one place and sell another, and essentially have the thing clear. For lack of a better term,
right.
He figured out a way to buy in one place, sell in the other place, and have it settle appropriately, which nobody else could figure out, but he did. I'm not saying nobody, but he did. He was making, what, $100,000 a day or something, just without even having a position, Wayne.
Yeah.
If he just would have stayed doing that, he'd have been wealthy. He could have bought half of Bahamas and just shut up. But no, nobody ever does that. They got to keep going until they screw up, right? Seemingly. Yeah. Anyway, thank you very much. But what do you got going this weekend? Anything good?
No, just recovering from the procedure.
Oh, gotcha.
Actually, when I walked into the hospital the other day, the woman said, "What's your name?" I gave her name. "Oh, you're here for the procedure."
Oh, good.
It just became like, oh, you're not allowed to say what it really is.
No, we can't. S&P futures down 6. Nasdaq futures down 48. Like I said, PPI number came in benign, so it's not causing the market to go down. We've actually rallied a little bit on that. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.